So let's move to and it's towards the end of your tenure with the JCL. It was actually said last night I was interviewing Ron Wakabayashi, and he said in many ways the election of Frank Sato to JCL president, following Floyd, was kind of interesting to him because it was a sign to him that the JCL National thought that they were close to the redress thing actually happening. And his thinking was, well, because Frank was kind of this the highest Nikkei civil servant and had these connections, and so they so he that was kind of his read. He says, oh, that's interesting. He thought this it was to him a sign that something was going on. I want to get your sense in terms of where JCL was at that board level and in many cases the behind the scenes, like who was going to be the next president.
Well, I think Frank Sato won by a landslide, like a few votes. He almost lost. So I don't know. It was in Hawaii. I don't know if there was a consensus that if Frank were elected, that it would be closer to redress. Like a lot of things, people didn't know Frank Sato. Frank Sato is one of those Nisei that is quiet, has accomplished so much, has made such a huge difference in government and American way we do politics and the way that we live, and people just don't know about it. But in and of itself, what's interesting is that because I think I want to say Frank won by a few votes. There was an event that we had in a party, and I think it was probably one of the JCL chapter meetings in Washington, D.C., and it was probably an installation dinner of some sort. And then the chief foreign minister for the embassy came by, and I think his name was Peter Sato, and he stood up and he says, oh, I want to congratulate landslide Frank Sato on winning the election. And everyone laughed because I think Frank eked out a win. So I don't know if necessarily the community knew that redress was closer to being done. I think there was momentum there. But at the same time, the momentum, the difficulty, like anything else, is that when you're fighting policymakers that are going to dictate things to a president, and that president will go along with it, it's really hard to move the legislation. I mean, you can move the legislation to the House and Senate, but getting it signed is a different situation. It's just like you may be able to move legislation in the House and Senate today, but if the president doesn't want to sign it, it's not gonna become law. And at that time, it's interesting how it took, in the last years of President Reagan's presidency, that, and I don't know, and I don't think people do because of what they want to see about their legacy. I think it's something that the time is ripe for it to happen. And in a large sense, if redress started from about 78 and legislation passed the way it did by 88, that's fast. Now, from a Japanese American viewpoint, took forever. Maybe never happened.
Yeah, because I talked to people who started,
Edison
1968
Uno,
or something.
right.
It's like, I think maybe that was the first resolution at a JCL National Convention, but they think it was more of like a two-decade experience.
Well, there's a couple things on redress. When it did pass, you felt happy. You felt sad for those that sacrificed so much that will never see that day happen. I think often about those that served in the military that gave so much, whether it's MIS 442nd or other branches of government that we may never know about. But also when you see the bigger picture of the politics that are involved, it's amazing that it did come about. I remember hearing the story about from Mike Masaoka, probably in 1978, about Ronald Reagan, you know, making that speech.
During World War II.
Right, because I think Mike, you know, one of the things that people may not understand is that Mike was probably one of the best media people the Japanese American community probably has ever had. I mean, I think the 442nd story wouldn't have come out the way that it did, you know, but for efforts of Mike and others to push the story forward. And, you know, even going forward and doing that movie, you know, that at that time, that was pretty big.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, very important. So, do you ever have a chance to talk with Senator Inouye when he was at Camp Shelby in Mississippi?
Yes. I interviewed him twice, so heard a lot of his stories.
You know, there's a person named Irene Hirano.
Yes.
Irene Hirano and I went to high school together.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Irene's father is Mike Yasutake. Mike Yasutake, if you go into the MIS books, is standing next to, Mr. Yasutake was a major. He was MIS. And Sparky was a captain. And I think he just came back from Europe with the Purple Heart. Mm-hmm. And Shigeru Mike Yasutake came back from Guadalcanal. And they were honored at probably Fort Savage by the commander for doing extraordinary work in the theater, Pacific and the European theater. And probably in 90 or so, I set up a meeting with Senator Matsunaga and Mike Yasutake. They hadn't seen each other since, you know, for 40 something years. And it was just like they saw each other the day before. Mm-hmm. And Senator Matsunaga would say, you know, Shig would come by, knock on my door on Sunday mornings to wake me up, and then we would walk together in the snow to church. Mm-hmm. And then Senator Matsunaga finds out that Mr. Yasutake's daughter is, you know, Irene Hirano, who was, you know, the president of the Japanese American National Museum. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was a lot of things like that came about, and you know, there's an interwoven story with the Japanese American community that you just sometimes don't even understand. Mm-hmm. You know, how it came about,
and how it's even generations, you know, mm-hmm. removed. It could be, yeah, mm-hmm. like that. That's interesting.